Carl adopted a wounded look.
Your Grace, I would never have supposed otherwise. I am arrogating this role to myself not to protect the young lady in question from any supposed malignity on your part, but simply because her current circumstances make establishing contact with her a somewhat troublesome business. Then pray tell me what you know about the young woman.
Carl gave the equity lord a brief description of Miranda's relationship with the Primer. Finkel McGraw was keenly interested in how much time Miranda had spent in the Primer each week. If your estimates are even approximately accurate, this young woman must have single-handedly done at least 9/10 of the racting associated with that copy of the Primer.
That copy? Do you mean to say there were others?
Finkel McGraw walked on silently for a few moments, then resumed in a quieter voice.
There were 3 copies in all. The first one went to my granddaughter, as you will appreciate. I tell you this in confidence. A second went to Fiona, the daughter of the artifacts who created it. The third fell into the hands of Nell, a little feat girl. To make a long story short, the 3 girls have turned out very differently. Elizabeth is rebellious and high-spirited, and lost interest in the Primer several years ago. Fiona is bright, but depressed, a classic manic-depressive artist. Nell, on the other hand, is a most promising young lady. I prepared an analysis of the girls' usage habits, which were largely obscured by the inherent secrecy of the media system, but which can be inferred from the bills we pay to hire the Ractors. It became clear that, in the case of Elizabeth, the racting was done by hundreds of different performers. In Fiona's case, the bills were strikingly lower, because much of the racting was done by someone who did not charge money for his or her services, probably her father. But that's a different story. In Nell's case, virtually all of the racting was done by the same person. It sounds, Carl said, as if my friend established a relationship with Nell's copy and, by extension, with Nell, said Lord Finkel McGraw.
Carl said, May I inquire as to why you wish to contact the Racta?
Because she is a central part of what is going on here, said Lord Finkel McGraw, which I did not expect. It was not a part of the original plan that the Racta would be important.
She did it, Carl Hollywood said, by sacrificing her career and much of her life. It is important for you to understand, Your Grace, that she was not merely Nell's tutor. She became Nell's mother.
These words seemed to strike Lord Finkel McGraw quite forcefully. His stride faltered, and he ambled along the river bank for some time, lost in thought.
You gave me to believe, several minutes ago, that establishing contact with the Ractor in question would not be a trivial process, he said finally in a quieter voice. Is she no longer associated with your troop?
She took a leave of absence several years ago in order to concentrate on Nell and the Primer, Carl said.
I see, said the Equity Lord, leaning into the words a little bit and turning it into an exclamation. He was getting excited.
Mr. Hollywood, I hope you will not be offended by my indelicacy in inquiring as to whether this has been a paid leave of absence.
Had it been necessary, I would have underwritten it. Instead, there is another backer.
Another backer? Repeated Finkel McGraw. He was obviously fascinated and slightly alarmed by the use of financial jargon in this context.
The transaction was fairly simple, as I suppose all transactions are, au fond, said Carl Hollywood. Miranda wanted to locate Nell. Conventional thinking dictates that this is impossible. There are, however, some unconventional thinkers who would maintain that it can be done through unconscious, non-rational processes. There is a tribe called the Drummers, who normally live underwater.
I am familiar with them, said Lord Finkel McGraw.
Miranda joined the Drummers 4 years ago, Carl said. She had entered into a partnership. The 2 other partners were a gentleman of my acquaintance, also in the theatrical business, and a financial backer. What did the backer hope to gain from it?
A leased line to the collective unconscious, said Carl Hollywood.
He thought it would be to the entertainment industry what the Philosopher's Stone was to alchemy.
And the results?
We have all been waiting to hear from Miranda.
You have heard nothing at all?
Only in my dreams, Carl Hollywood said.
Nell's passage through Pudong. She happens upon the offices of Madame Ping. Interview with the same. Shanghai proper could be glimpsed only through vertical apertures between the high buildings of the Pudong Economic Zone as Nell skated westward. Downtown Pudong erupted from the flat paddy land on the east bank of the Huangpu. Almost all of the skyscrapers made use of mediatronic building materials. Some bore the streamlined characters of the Japanese writing system, rendered in sophisticated color schemes, but most of them were written in the denser, high-resolution characters used by the Chinese, and these tended to be stroked out in fiery red or in black on a background of that color. The Anglo-Americans had their Manhattan, the Japanese had Tokyo. Hong Kong was a nice piece of work, but it was essentially Western. When the overseas Chinese came back to the homeland to build their monument to enterprise, they had done it here, and they had done it bigger and brighter and unquestionably redder than any of those other cities. The nanotechnological trick of making sturdy structures that were lighter than air had come along just at the right time, as all of the last paddies were being replaced by immense concrete foundations, and a canopy of new construction had bloomed above the first-generation undergrowth of 70- and 80-story buildings. This new architecture was naturally large and ellipsoidal, typically consisting of a huge neon-rimmed ball impaled on a spike. So Pudong was bigger and denser 1,000 feet above the ground than it was at street level. Seen from the apex of the big arch in the causeway through several miles of bad air, the view was curiously flattened and faded, as if the whole scene had been woven into a fabulously complex brocade that had been allowed to gather dust for several decades and then been hung in front of Nell about 10 feet away. The sun had gone down not long before, and the sky was still a dim orange fading up into purple, divided into irregular segments by 6 pillars of smoke spurting straight up out of the horizon and toward the dark, polluted vault of the heavens, many miles off to the west, somewhere out in the silk and tea districts between Shanghai and Suzhou. As she power-skated down the western slope of the arch and crossed the coastline of China, the thunderhead of neon reached above her head, spread out to embrace her, developed into 3 dimensions, and she was still several miles away from it. The coastal neighborhoods consisted of block after block of reinforced concrete apartment buildings, 4 to 5 stories high, looking older than the Great Wall, though their real age could not have exceeded a few decades, and decorated on the ends facing the street with large cartoonish billboards, some mediatronic, most just painted on. For the first kilometer or so, most of these were targeted at businessmen just coming in from New Chuzan, and in particular from the New Atlantis clave. Glancing at these billboards as she went by them, Nell concluded that visitors from New Atlantis played an important role in supporting casinos and bordellos, both the old-fashioned variety and the newer scripted fantasy emporia, where you could be the star in a little play you wrote yourself. Nell slowed down to examine several of these, memorizing the addresses of ones with especially new or well-executed signs. She had no clear plan in mind yet. All she knew was that she had to keep moving purposefully. Then the young men squatting on the curbs talking into their cell phones would keep eyeing her but leave her alone. The moment she stopped or looked the tiniest bit uncertain, they would descend. The dense wet air along the Huangpu was supporting millions of tons of air buoys, and Nell felt every kilogram of their weight pressing upon her ribs and shoulders as she skated up and down the main waterfront thoroughfare, trying to maintain her momentum and her false sense of purposefulness. This was the coastal republic, which appeared to have no fixed principles, other than that money talked and that it was a good thing to get rich. Every tribe in the world seemed to have its own skyscraper here. Some, like New Atlantis, were not actively recruiting and simply used the size and magnificence of their buildings as a monument to themselves. Others, like the Boers, the Parsis, the Jews, went for the understated approach, and in Pudong, anything understated was more or less invisible. Still others, the Mormons, the First Distributed Republic, and the Chinese Coastal Republic itself, used every square inch of their mediatronic walls to proselytize. The only file that didn't seem to appreciate the ecumenical spirit of the place was the Celestial Kingdom itself. Nell stumbled across their territory, half a square block surrounded with a stucco-sheathed masonry wall, circular gates here and there, and an old three-story structure inside, done in high Ming style, with eaves that curved way up at the corners and sculpted dragons along the ridgeline of the roof. The place was so tiny compared to the rest of Pudong that it looked as if you might trip over it. The gates were guarded by men in armor, presumably backed up by other, less obvious defensive systems. Nell was fairly certain that she was being followed, unobtrusively, by at least three young men who had locked on to her during her initial passage in from the coast, and who were waiting to find out whether she really had somewhere to go or was just faking it. She had already made her way from one end of the waterfront to the other, pretending to be a tourist who just wanted to take in the view of the Bund across the river. She was now heading back into the heart of downtown Pudong, where she had better look as if she were doing something. Passing by the grand entrance to one of the skyscrapers, a coastal republic edifice, not barbarian turf, she recognized its mediaglyphic logo from one of the signs she had seen on the way into town. Nell could at least fill out an application without committing herself. It would allow her to kill an hour in relatively safe and clean surroundings. The important thing, as Dojo had taught her long ago in a different context, was not to stop. Without movement, she could do nothing. Alas, Madame Ping's office suite was closed. A few lights were on in the back, but the doors were locked, and no receptionist was on duty. Nell did not know whether to be amused or annoyed. Whoever heard of a brothel that closed down after dark? But then these were only the administrative offices. She loitered in the lobby for a few minutes, then caught a down elevator. Just as the doors were closing, someone jumped into the lobby and slammed the button, opening them back up again. A young Chinese man with a small, slender body, large head, neatly dressed, carrying some papers. "Pardon me," he said. "Did you require something?" "I'm here to apply for a job," Nell said. The man's eyes traveled up and down her body in a coolly professional fashion, almost completely devoid of prurience, starting and stopping on her face. "As a performer," he said. The intonation was somewhere between a question and a declaration. "As a scriptwriter," she said. Unexpectedly, he broke into a grin. "I have qualifications that I will explain in detail." "We have writers. We contract for them on the network." "I'm surprised. How can a contract writer in Minnesota possibly provide your clients with the personalized service they require?"
"You could almost certainly get the job as a performer," said the young man. "You would start tonight. Good pay."
"Just by looking at the billboards on the way in, I could see that your customers aren't paying for bodies. They are paying for ideas. That's your value added, right?"
"Pardon me?" said the young man, grinning again.
"Your value added. The reason you can charge more than a whorehouse, pardon my language, is that you provide a scripted fantasy scenario tailored to the client's requirements. I can do that for you," Nell said. "I know these people, and I can make you a lot of money."
"You know what people?"
"The Vickies. I know them inside and out," Nell said. "Please come inside," said the young man, gesturing toward the diamondoid door with Madame Ping's written on it in red letters. "Would you care for tea?"
"There are only two industries. This has always been true," said Madame Ping, enfolding a lovely porcelain teacup in her withered fingers, the 2-inch fingernails interleaving neatly like the pinions of a raptor folding its wings after a long, hard day of cruising the thermals. "There is the industry of things and the industry of entertainment. The industry of things comes first. It keeps us alive. But making things is easy now that we have the feed. This is not a very interesting business anymore. After people have the things they need to live, everything else is entertainment. Everything. This is Madame Ping's business."
Madame Ping had an office on the 111th floor with a nice, unobstructed view across the Huangpu and into downtown Shanghai. When it wasn't foggy, she could even see the facade of her theater, which was on a side street a couple of blocks in from the Bund, its Mediatronic marquee glowing patchily through the dumb limbs of an old sycamore tree. She had a telescope mounted in one of her windows, fixed upon the theater's entrance, and, noting Nell's curiosity, she encouraged her to look through it. Nell had never looked through a real telescope before. It had a tendency to jiggle and go out of focus, it didn't zoom, and panning was tricky. But for all that, the image quality was a lot better than photographic, and she quickly forgot herself and began sweeping it back and forth across the city. She checked out the little celestial kingdom clave in the heart of the old city, where a couple of mandarins stood on a zigzag bridge across a pond, contemplating a swarm of golden carp, wispy silver beards trailing down over the colorful silk of their lapels, blue sapphire buttons on their caps flashing as they nodded their heads. She looked into a high-rise building farther inland, apparently a foreign concession of some type, where some Euros were holding a cocktail party, some venturing onto the balcony with glasses of wine and doing some eavesdropping of their own. Finally, she leveled the scope toward the horizon, out past the dangerous triad-ridden suburbs where millions of Shanghai's poor had been forcibly banished to make way for high-rises. Beyond that was real agricultural land, a fractal network of canals and creeks glimmering like a golden net as they reflected the lambency of the sunset, and beyond that, as always, a few scattered pillars of smoke in the ultimate distance, where the fists of righteous harmony were burning the foreign devil's feed lines.
"You are a curious girl," Madam Ping said. "That is natural. But you must never let any other person, especially a client, see your curiosity. Never seek information. Sit quietly and let them bring it to you. What they conceal tells you more than what they reveal. Do you understand?"
"Yes, madam," Nell said, turning toward her interlocutor with a little curtsy. Rather than trying to do Chinese etiquette and making a hash of it, she was taking the Victorian route, which worked just as well. For purposes of this interview, Henry, the young man who had offered her tea, had advanced her a few hard yukus, which he had used to compile a reasonably decent full-length dress, hat, gloves, and reticule. She had gone in nervous, and realized within a few minutes that the decision to hire her had already been made somehow, and that this little get-together was actually more along the lines of an orientation session.
"Why is the Victorian market important to us?" Madam Ping asked, and fixed Nell with an incisive glare.
"Because New Atlantis is one of the three first-tier files."
"Not correct. The wealth of New Atlantis is great, yes, but its population is just a few percent. The successful New Atlantis man is busy and has just a bit of time for scripted fantasies. He has much money, you understand, but little opportunity to spend it. No, this market is important because everyone else, the men of all other files, including many of Nippon, want to be like Victorian gentlemen. Look at the Ashantis, the Jews, the Coastal Republic. Do they wear traditional costume? Sometimes. Usually, though, they wear a suit on the Victorian pattern. They carry an umbrella from Old Bond Street. They have a book of Sherlock Holmes stories. They play in Victorian ractives. And when they have to spend their natural urges, they come to me. And I provide them with a scripted fantasy that was, originally, requested by some gentleman who came sneaking across the causeway from New Atlantis."
Somewhat uncharacteristically, Madam Ping turned two of her claws into walking legs and made them scurry across the tabletop like a furtive Vicky Gent trying to slip into Shanghai without being caught on a monitor. Recognizing her cue, Nell covered her mouth with one gloved hand and tittered.
"This way, Madam Ping does a magic trick. She turns one satisfied client from New Atlantis into 1,000 clients from all tribes."
"I must confess that I am surprised," Nell ventured. "Inexperienced as I am in these matters, I had supposed that each tribe would exhibit a different preference."
"We changed the script a little," Madam Ping said, "to allow for cultural differences. But the story never changes. There are many people and many tribes, but only so many stories."
Peculiar Practices in the Woods. The Reformed Distributed Republic. An Extraordinary Conversation in a Log Cabin.
Cripnet. The Hackworths Depart. Half a day's slow eastward ride took them well up into the foothills of the Cascades, where the clouds, flowing in eternally from the Pacific, were forced upward by the swelling terrain and unburdened themselves of their immense stores of moisture. The trees were giants, rising branchless to far above their heads, the trunks aglow with moss. The landscape was a checkerboard of old-growth forest alternating with patches that had been logged in the previous century. Hackworth tried to guide Kidnapper toward the latter, because the scarcity of undergrowth and deadfalls made for a smoother ride. They passed through the remains of an abandoned timber town, half small clapboard buildings and half moss-covered and rust-streaked mobile homes. Through their dirty windows, faded signs were dimly visible, stenciled, "This household depends on timber money." 10-foot saplings grew up through cracks in the streets. Narrow hedges of blueberry shrubs and blackberry canes sprouted from the rain gutters of houses, and gigantic old cars, resting askew on flat and cracked tires, had become trellises for morning glories and vine maples. They also passed through an old mining encampment that had been abandoned even longer ago. For the most part, the signs of modern habitation were relatively subtle. The houses up here tended to be of the same unassuming style favored by the software cons closer to Seattle, and from place to place a number of them would cluster around a central square with playground equipment, cafes, stores, and other amenities. He and Fiona stopped at two such places to exchange yukus for coffee, sandwiches, and cinnamon rolls. The unmarked, decussating paths would have been confusing to anyone but a native. Hackworth had never been here before. He had gotten the coordinates from the second fortune cookie in Kidnapper's glove compartment, which was much less cryptic than the first had been. He had no way to tell whether he was really going anywhere. His faith did not begin to waver until evening approached. The eternal clouds changed from silver to dark gray, and he noticed that the Cheveline was taking them higher and toward less densely populated ground. Then he saw the rocks and knew he had chosen the right path. A wall of brown granite, dark and damp from the condensing fog, materialized before them. They heard it before they saw it. It made no sound, but its presence changed the acoustics of the forest. The fog was closing in, and they could barely see the silhouettes of scrubby, wind-gnarled mountain trees lined up uncomfortably along the top of the cliff. Amid those trees was the silhouette of a human being. Quiet, Hackworth mouthed to his daughter, then reined Kidnapper to a stop. The person had a short haircut and wore a bulky waist-length jacket with stretch pants. They could tell by the curve of the hips that it was a woman. Around those hips she had fastened an arrangement of neon green straps, a climbing harness. She wore no other outdoor paraphernalia, though, no knapsack or helmet, and behind her, on the clifftop, they could just make out the silhouette of a horse, prodding the ground with its nose. From time to time, she checked her wristwatch. A tenuous neon strand of rope hung down from the bulging face of the cliff from where the woman stood. The last several meters dangled loosely in the mist in front of a small, cozy pocket sheltered by the overhang. Hackworth turned around to get Fiona's attention, then pointed something out. A second person, making his way along the base of the cliff, out of sight of the woman above. Moving carefully and quietly, he eventually reached the shelter of the overhang. He gingerly took the dangling end of the rope and tied it to something, apparently a piece of hardware fixed into the rock. Then he left the way he had come, moving silently and staying close to the cliff. The woman remained still and silent for several minutes, checking her watch more and more frequently. Finally, she backed several paces away from the edge of the cliff, took her hands out of her jacket pockets, seemed to draw a few deep breaths, then ran forward and launched herself into space. She screamed as she did it, a scream to drive out her own fear. The rope ran through a pulley fixed near the top of the cliff. She fell for a few meters, the rope tightened, the man's knot held, and the rope, which was somewhat elastic, brought her to a firm but not violent stop, just above the wicked pile of rubble and snags at the base of the cliff. Swinging at the end of the rope, she grabbed it with one hand and leaned back, baring her throat to the mist, allowing herself to dangle listlessly for a few minutes, basking in relief. A third person, previously unseen, emerged from the trees. This one was a middle-aged man, and he was wearing a jacket that had a few vaguely official touches, such as an armband and an insignia on the breast pocket. He walked beneath the dangling woman and busied himself for a few moments beneath the overhang, eventually releasing the rope and letting her safely to the ground. The woman detached herself from the rope, and then the harness, and fell into a businesslike discussion with this man, who poured both of them hot drinks from a thermal flask.
"Have you heard of these people? The Reform Distributed Republic," Hackworth said to Fiona, still keeping his voice low.
"I am only familiar with the first."
"The First Distributed Republic doesn't hang together very well. In a way, it was never designed to. It was started by a bunch of people who were very nearly anarchists. As you've probably learned in school, it's become awfully factionalized."
"I have some friends in the FDR," Fiona said.
"Your neighbors?"
"Yes."
"Software cons," Hackworth said. "The FDR works for them because they have something in common. Old software money. They're almost like Victorians. A lot of them cross over and take the oath as they get older. But for the broad middle class, the FDR offers no central religion or ethnic identity."
"So it becomes balkanized."
"Precisely. These people," Hackworth said, pointing to the man and the woman at the base of the cliff, "are RDR, Reform Distributed Republic, very similar to FDR, with one key difference."
"The ritual we just witnessed."
"Ritual is a good description," Hackworth said. "Earlier today, that man and that woman were both visited by messengers who gave them a place and time, nothing else. In this case, the woman's job was to jump off that cliff at the given time. The man's job was to tie the end of the rope before she jumped. A very simple job."
"But if he had failed to do it, she'd be dead," Fiona said.
"Precisely. The names are pulled out of a hat. The participants have only a few hours' warning. Here, the ritual is done with a cliff and a rope, because there happened to be a cliff in the vicinity. In other RDR nodes, the mechanism might be different. For example, person A might go into a room, take a pistol out of a box, load it with live ammunition, put it back in the box, and then leave the room for 10 minutes. During that time, person B is supposed to enter the room and replace the live ammunition with a dummy clip having the same weight. Then person A comes back into the room, puts the gun to his head, and pulls the trigger."
"But person A has no way of knowing whether person B has done his job?"
"Exactly."
"What is the role of the third person?"
"A proctor, an official of the RDR who sees to it that the two participants don't try to communicate."
"How frequently must they undergo this ritual?"
"As frequently as their name comes up at random, perhaps once every couple of years," Hackworth said. "It's a way of creating mutual dependency. These people know they can trust each other. In a tribe such as the FDR, whose view of the universe contains no absolutes, this ritual creates an artificial absolute." The woman finished her hot drink, shook hands with the proctor, then began to ascend a polymer ladder fixed to the rock that took her back toward her horse. Hackworth spurred Kidnapper into movement, following a path that ran parallel to the base of the cliff, and rode for half a kilometer or so, until it was joined by another path angling down from above. A few minutes later, the woman approached, riding her horse, an old-fashioned biological model. She was a healthy, open-faced, apple-cheeked woman, still invigorated by her leap into the unknown, and she greeted them from some distance away without any of the reserve of Neo-Victorians. "How do you do?" Hackworth said, removing his bowler. The woman barely glanced at Fiona. She reined her horse to a gentle stop, eyes fixed on Hackworth's face. She was wearing a distracted look.
"I know you," she said, "but I don't know your name."
"Hackworth, John Percival, at your service. This is my daughter, Fiona."
"I'm sure I've never heard that name," the woman said.
"I'm sure I've never heard yours," Hackworth said cheerfully. "Maggie," the woman said,
"this is driving me crazy. Where have we met?"
"This may sound rather odd," Hackworth said gently, "but if you and I could both remember all of our dreams, which we can't, of course, and if we compared notes long enough, we would probably find that we had shared a few over the years."
"A lot of people have similar dreams," Maggie said.
"Excuse me, but that's not what I mean,"
Hackworth said. I refer to a situation in which each of us would retain his or her own personal point of view. I would see you, you would see me. We might then share certain experiences together, each of us seeing it from our own perspective. Like a Reactive? Yes, Hackworth said, but you don't have to pay for it. Not with money, anyway. The local climate lent itself to hot drinks. Maggie did not even take off her jacket before going into her kitchen and putting a kettle on to boil. The place was a log cabin, airier than it looked from the outside, and Maggie apparently shared it with several other people who were not there at the moment. Fiona, walking to and from the bathroom, was fascinated to see evidence of men and women living and sleeping and bathing together. As they sat around having their tea, Hackworth persuaded Maggie to poke her finger into a thimble-sized device. When he took this object from his pocket, Fiona was struck by a powerful sense of déjà vu. She had seen it before, and it was significant. She knew that her father had designed it. It bore all the earmarks of his style. Then they all sat around making small talk for a few minutes. Fiona had many questions about the workings of the RDR, which Maggie was pleased to answer. Hackworth had spread a sheet of blank paper out on the table, and as the minutes went by, words and pictures began to appear on it and to scroll up the page after it had filled itself up. The thimble, he explained, had placed some reconnaissance mites into Maggie's bloodstream, which had been gathering information, flying out through her pores when their tape drives were full, and offloading the data into the paper. "It seems that you and I have a mutual acquaintance, Maggie," he said after a few minutes. "We are carrying many of the same tuples in our bloodstreams. They can only be spread through certain forms of contact."
"You mean like exchange of bodily fluids?" Maggie said blankly.
Fiona thought briefly of old-fashioned transfusions and probably would not have worked out the real meaning of this phrase had her father not flushed and glanced at her momentarily.
"I believe we understand each other, yes," Hackworth said.
Maggie thought about it for a moment and seemed to get irked, or as irked as someone with her generous and contented nature was ever likely to get. She addressed Hackworth, but watched Fiona as she tried to construct her next sentence. "Despite what blue lanterns might think of us, I don't have that many partners.
I am sorry to have given you the mistaken impression that I had formed any untoward preconceptions about your moral standards," Hackworth said. "Please be assured that I do not regard myself as being in any position to judge others in this regard. However, if you could be so forthcoming as to tell me who, or with whom, in the last year or so..."
"Just one," Maggie said. "It's been a slow year." Then she set her tea mug down on the table. Fiona had been startled by the unavailability of saucers, and leaned back in her chair, looking at Hackworth alertly. "Funny that I'm telling you this stuff, you a stranger."
"Please allow me to recommend that you trust your instincts and treat me not as a stranger."
"I had a fling, months and months ago. That's been it."
"Where?"
"London." A trace of a smile came onto Maggie's face. "You'd think living here I'd go someplace warm and sunny, but I went to London. I guess there's a little Victorian in all of us." "It was a guy," Maggie went on. "I had gone to London with a couple of girlfriends of mine. One of them was another RDR citizen, and the other, Trish, left the RDR about 3 years ago and co-founded a local Cryptnet node. They've got a little point of presence down in Seattle near the market."
"Please pardon me for interrupting," Fiona said, "but would you be so kind as to explain the nature of Cryptnet? One of my old school friends seems to have joined it." "A synthetic file, elusive in the extreme," Hackworth said.
"Each node is independent and self-governing," Maggie said. "You could found a node tomorrow if you wanted. Nodes are defined by contracts. You sign a contract in which you agree to provide certain services when called upon to do so."
"What sorts of services?"
"Well, typically, data is delivered into your system. You process the data and pass it on to other nodes. It seemed like a natural to Trish because she was a coder, like me and my housemates and most other people around here."
"Nodes have computers, then?"
"The people themselves have computers, typically embedded systems," Maggie said, unconsciously rubbing the mastoid bone behind her ear.
Is the node synonymous with the person, then?
In many cases, Maggie said, but sometimes it's several persons with embedded systems that are contained within the same trust boundary.
May I ask what level your friend Trish's node has attained? Hackworth said.
Maggie looked uncertain.
8 or 9, maybe? Anyway, we went to London. While we were there, we decided to take in some shows. I wanted to see the big productions. Those were nice. We saw a nice Dr. Faustus at the Olivier.
Marlowe's?
Yes, but Trish had a knack for finding all of these little, scruffy, out-of-the-way theaters that I never would have found in a million years. They weren't marked, and they didn't really advertise as far as I could tell. We saw some radical stuff. Really radical.
I don't imagine you were using that adjective in a political sense, Hackworth said.
No, I mean how they were staged. In one of them, we walked into this bombed-out old building in Whitechapel, full of people milling around, and all this weird stuff started happening. And after a while, I realized that some of the people were actors, and some were audience, and that all of us were both, in a way. It was cool. I suppose you can get stuff like that on the net any time, interactive, but it was so much better to be there, with real, warm bodies around. I felt happy. Anyway, this guy was going to the bar for a pint, and he offered to get me one. We started talking. One thing led to another. He was really intelligent, really sexy. An African guy who knew a lot about the theater. This place had back rooms. Some of them had beds.
After you were finished, Hackworth said, did you experience any unusual sensations?
Maggie threw back her head and laughed, thinking that this was a bit of wry humor on Hackworth's part, but he was serious.
After we were finished? She said.
Yes. Let us say, several minutes afterward.
Suddenly Maggie became disconcerted.
Yeah, actually, she said. I got hot. Really hot. We had to leave because I thought I had a flu or something. We went back to the hotel, and I took my clothes off and stood out on the balcony. My temperature was 104. But the next morning I felt fine, and I've felt fine ever since.
Thank you, Maggie, Hackworth said, rising to his feet and pocketing the sheet of paper. Fiona rose too, following her father's cue. Prior to your London visit, had your social life been an active one?
Maggie got a little pinker.
Relatively active for a few years, yes.
What sort of crowd? Cripnet types? People who spent a lot of time near the water?
Maggie shook her head.
The water? I don't understand.
Ask yourself why you have been so inactive, Maggie, since your liaison with Mr. Beck. Could it be that you found the experience just a bit alarming? Exchange of bodily fluids followed by a violent rise in core temperature?
Maggie was poker-faced.
I recommend that you look into the subject of spontaneous combustion, Hackworth said.
And without further ceremony, he reclaimed his bowler and umbrella from the entryway and led Fiona back out into the forest.
Hackworth said, Maggie did not tell you everything about Cripnet. To begin with, it is believed to have numerous unsavory connections and is a perennial focus of protocol enforcement's investigations. And, Hackworth laughed ruefully, it is patently untrue that 10 is the highest level.
What is the goal of this organization? Fiona asked.
It represents itself as a simple, moderately successful data processing collective. But its actual goals can only be known by those privileged to be included within the trust boundary of the 33rd level, Hackworth said, his voice slowing down as he tried to remember why he knew all of these things. It is rumored that, within that select circle, any member can kill any other simply by thinking of the deed.
Fiona leaned forward and wrapped her arms snugly around her father's body, nestled her head between his shoulder blades, and held tight. She thought that the subject of Cripnet was closed, but a quarter of an hour later, as Kidnapper carried them swiftly through the trees down toward Seattle, her father spoke again, picking up the sentence where he had left it, as if he had merely paused for breath. His voice was slow and distant, and almost trance-like, the memories percolating outward from deep storage with little participation from his conscious mind. Cripnet's true desire is the seed. A technology that, in their diabolical scheme, will one day supplant the feed,
upon which our society and many others are founded. Protocol, to us, has brought prosperity and peace. To Kryptnet, however, it is a contemptible system of oppression. They believe that information has an almost mystical power of free flow and self-replication, as water seeks its own level or sparks fly upward, and lacking any moral code, they confuse inevitability with right. It is their view that one day, instead of feeds terminating in matter compilers, we will have seeds that, sown on the earth, will sprout up into houses, hamburgers, spaceships, and books, that the seed will develop inevitably from the feed, and that upon it will be founded a more highly evolved society. He stopped for a moment, took a deep breath, and seemed to stir awake. When he spoke again, it was in a clearer and stronger voice. Of course, it can't be allowed. The feed is not a system of control and oppression as Kryptnet would maintain. It is the only way order can be maintained in modern society. If everyone possessed a seed, anyone could produce weapons whose destructive power rivaled that of Elizabethan nuclear weapons. This is why protocol enforcement takes such a dim view of Kryptnet's activities. The trees parted to reveal a long blue lake below them. Kidnapper found its way to a road, and Hackworth spurred it on to a hand gallop. Within a few hours, father and daughter were settling into bunk beds in a second-class cabin of the airship Falkland Islands, bound for London. From the Primer, Princess Nell's activities as Duchess of Turing, the Castle of the Watergates, other castles, the Cipherer's Market. Nell prepares for her final journey. Princess Nell remained in Castle Turing for several months. During her quest for the 12 keys, she had entered many castles, outwitted their sentries, picked their locks, and rifled their treasuries. But Castle Turing was an altogether different place, a place that ran on rules and programs that were devised by men and that could be rewritten by one who was adept in the language of the ones and zeros. She need not content herself with sneaking in, seizing a trinket, and fleeing. Castle Turing she made her own. Its domain became Princess Nell's kingdom. First, she gave the Duke of Turing a decent burial. Then she studied his books until she had mastered them. She acquainted herself with the states by which the soldiers and the mechanical duke could be programmed. She entered a new master program into the duke and then restarted the turning of the mighty shaft that powered the castle. Her first efforts were unsuccessful, as her program contained many errors. The original duke himself had not been a puppet. He called them bugs, in reference to a large beetle that had become entangled in one of his chains during an early experiment and brought the first Turing machine to a violent halt. But with steadfast patience, Princess Nell resolved these bugs and made the mechanical duke into her devoted servant. The duke, in turn, had the knack of putting simple programs into all of the soldiers, so that an order given him by Nell was rapidly disseminated into the entire force. For the first time in her life, the princess had an army and servants. But it was not a conquering sort of army, because the springs in the soldiers' backs unwound rapidly, and they did not have the adaptability of human soldiers. Still, it was an effective force behind the walls of the castle, and made her secure from any conceivable aggressor. Following maintenance schedules that had been laid down by the original duke, Princess Nell set the soldiers to work, greasing the gears, repairing cracked shafts and worn bearings, and building new soldiers out of stockpiled parts. She was heartened by her success, but Castle Turing was only one of seven ducal seats in this kingdom, and she knew she had much work to do. The territory around the castle was deeply forested, but grassy ridges rose several miles away, and standing on the castle walls with the original duke's spyglass, Nell was able to see wild horses grazing there. Purple had taught her the secrets of mastering wild horses, and Duck had taught her how to win their affection, and so Nell mounted an expedition to these grasslands and returned a week later with two beautiful mustangs, Coffee and Cream. She equipped them with fine tack from the duke's stables, marked with the T crest, for the crest was hers now, and she could, with justification, call herself the Duchess of Turing.
She also brought a plain, unmarked saddle so that she could pass for a commoner if need be, though Princess May had become so beautiful over the years and had developed such a fine bearing that few people would mistake her for a commoner now, even if she were dressed in rags and walking barefoot.